In the early 1940s, the important Swedish export-import firm of Mittan Europische Handels occupied a suite of offices in Stockholm next to that of our financial attaché to the American embassy. Raoul Wallenberg was at 32 years of age the youngest director of this company. He was a scion of an important Swedish family. He had been trained and educated in the best schools on the continent. His father and his grandfather won for him a place in Swedish aristocracy, and a great future in the business world was predicted by all for this bright, agreeable, affable young man. The American financial attaché, Mr. Olson, met Raoul Wallenberg in the course of their business day. They became friends. They found that they had interests in common in art and in architecture, and they quickly became fast friends. By March of 1944, the pendulum of battle had begun to swing towards the Allies. Stalingrad and El Alamein and the Battle of Britain had blunted the sword of the Nazis, and there was now sure hope that the day of final reckoning was not far off. But among the problems raised by this turn of events, one of the most serious was that of the plight of the 1.5 million Jews of Hungary. The Hungarian government under Premier Horthy had been from the beginning a willing partner of the Axis. But it had not followed its Nazi leadership in one respect. It had not undertaken a campaign of mass extermination against its Jewish community. 300,000 Jews still remained in the capital city of Budapest. Several hundred thousand more were scattered in cities around the countryside. The American and allied Jewish communities and the allied governments feared that in their frustration, the wrath of the Germans and of their Hungarian counterparts would be turned against this defenseless community, and that they would be made to feel the burden of this Nazi defeat. It was decided to send an important neutral nation diplomat to Budapest to organize a rescue mission to bring what succor and help might be brought to these poor people. When Ambassador Johnson called together his staff in Stockholm for suggestions as to this mission, his financial attaché suggested the name of his friend Raoul Wallenberg. And Wallenberg was summoned to the ambassador's office. The mission was explained to him, its humanitarian possibilities and also its dangers. Now, Raoul Wallenberg had 100 good reasons why he should not undertake this dangerous rescue mission. He had a home to support, a girl in which he was interested, a business which he was, for the first time, beginning to achieve great things. He asked for time. He had no primary concern or responsibility for the Jewish community or for the Jews of Hungary. But he recognized the importance of this mission, and in March of 1944, he agreed to go. In July of 1944, he arrived in Budapest. In January of 1945, the Russian troops reconquered the city. Between July of 1944 and January of 1945, one out of every two Hungarian Jews was either deported, put to death, or sent to one of the death camps of Auschwitz or Dachau. Between July of 1944 and January of 1945, Raoul Wallenberg managed to hide, save, conceal, succor, free perhaps some 50,000 Jews. He managed to bring medical aid, comfort, advice, to countless thousands more. Unlike the Germans, he had no army behind him. He might have simply allowed himself to hand out medical supplies and food and content himself with sending back despairing reports to his superiors. But day after day, day and night, he exposed himself to danger. Whenever he heard of a death train about to go on its way to one of the camps, he would go down to the station and surreptitiously pass out Swedish protective papers to as many as he could reach, and then demand that the Nazis free all those who were protected by a neutral flag. He organized a Section C in the Swedish legation, in which he managed to employ 660 people, and in so doing, give diplomatic immunity to them and to their families. It is said that the railroad line between Budapest and Auschwitz was blown up under his direction. Hour after hour, he tirelessly worked to save those peoples whom he could and to bring a measure of comfort to others. He organized hospitals, havens, orphanages, relief missions of all types. In December of 1944, the Hungarian government ordered all neutral nation diplomats to stay off the street. The city was being shelled. The military law reigned, and it was felt to be unsafe. Raoul Wallenberg would not abide safely in his office. Again, he went abroad whenever he was needed. And on a mission in January of 1945, just a week before the Russians reconquered the city, from his office to the central ghetto of Budapest, he disappeared, done to death by the Nazis, in all probability, whose plans and schemes he had done so much to foil. Today, a statue in his honor features the gateway to the Central Jewish Hospital in Budapest. Raoul Wallenberg has left behind him a memory rich in blessing, and one which the Jewish community of Hungary will not soon forget. I read this saga of heroism recently, an interesting report of a man named Philip Friedman, in which he details many of the acts of heroism by which non-Jews all over Europe saved their Jewish neighbors from Nazi extermination. In this book, you see detailed for you a pantheon of non-Jewish heroes who gambled their own lives and often lost the gamble in order to hide and to speed off to safety Jewish friends. The book itself is not well written. It is called Their Brother's Keeper, but it is well worth the reading. It is worth the reading because I think it will reconvince us of the essential worthwhileness of human nature. Our faith was somewhat shattered by the experiences of the Second World War and by the tensions of the Cold War. But reading a saga of heroism as broad in sweep and scope as this does a great deal to make us realize that there are indeed men of goodwill in all countries, peoples, and nations. I was especially taken by one fact which becomes crystal clear as you read through these pages. These heroes come from all walks and levels of society. Wallenberg was a member of the Swedish aristocracy. But you meet here also Josefek, who is a down-in-the-cups Polish cattle dealer who hid 35 Jews in his barn and in so doing lost his life. You meet an Italian newspaper editor, a Czech pastor, a French housewife, a Dutch burgher, a Polish beggar, a Hungarian farmer. And you realize again the universality of virtue, universality of our humanity, which all too often we forget. This book gives the lie direct to all those pseudo-philosophies and pseudo-sociologies of snobbery, which separate men into classes, which tell us that virtue, courage, heroism, can be found only in certain groups, usually our group, while the rest of the people are beneath contempt outside the pale, rabble, the crowd, the mass, common, ordinary. It's important to keep this basic truth in the forefront of our thought. All too often, each of us is prone to think of ourselves as somehow better than some group whom we do not know. And I think if we are honest with ourselves, we will admit that when we think of certain groups in our society, say the Oriental group, or the Negro group, or the poor white trash, we do not expect to find there the same virtues, the same decencies, the same evidence of human dignity that we expect among those whom we consider our equals or our betters. And one of the tragedies of world history is that all too often the philosophies and theologies of men have sanctified and sanctioned such snobbery and such prejudice. We have only to think of the religions of traditional India, religions which sanctified a caste, rigid caste system. The Brahmin, to him belonged all honor, justice, and virtue. And the people, the original peoples of India who had been overcome in a later mass immigration, were declared to be untouchables, beneath contempt. And it's hard to see how those with whom you are unable to communicate or to eat or to work, how you can expect to find in these peoples the same heroism of spirit, nobility of bearing, which you would expect of those of the upper and more elite classes. The Greeks knew a great deal about philosophy. They gave to us our logic, our whole philosophic system. But they were not wise in the ways of brotherhood, for it was the Greeks who could not see the humanity of the serfs and the slaves. Aristotle, for all his wisdom, could think of the slaves of his day only as living tools, an almost subhuman species. And he advocated the religions of his day because it kept these animal beings in line, quiet and supine. And unfortunately, this class arrogance has passed over from the Greeks to the Romans and from the Romans to the Middle Ages and to all the fascist and dictatorial and aristocratic states of our day. Always there is an in-group and an out-group. Some who are human, noble, some who are subhuman, boorish, common. To read the saga of heroism of their brother's keeper is to realize the essential truth which our faith has struggled to make the world aware. Our Bible starts with a preamble. All men are created of one set of parents. And the rabbis emphasize this by saying that Adam, the name of the first man, means simply earth. Adam was made of the earth, of the black earth of clay, the white earth of sand, of the yellow earth of loam. All the races were commingled in him and flow from him. We have an equal parentage, each of us. And the rabbis of our people were happy to point out to some of our overproud ancestors that Israel makes no claims of birth or blood. We do not claim that there are in the Bible inferior races or superior races, chosen peoples or contemptible peoples. Have we not all one Father? Hath not one God created us all? And when they, our ancestors, preened themselves on their accomplishments and said, must not we be a specially dowered people? Then the rabbis pointed to them and said, look, you are the sons of slaves. God brought you out of serfdom, out of poverty, out of illiteracy, Erev Rav Alitem. You went up out of Egypt, a mixed rabble, nothing more. There was then nothing distinctive or cultured or fine about you. What you have accomplished is a tribute to your determination. But it is also evidence that those who still suffer, those who are still in a servile state, have within them the seed of similar accomplishments. If men will only give them the opportunity to develop and extend and to flourish. The prophet Amos warned the people of his day that they should not believe that God had any special favor to lavish upon them. For the Jews, he said, pride themselves that God brought them out of the land of Egypt. But they should also remember that he brought the Philistines out of Crete. And he brought the Syrians out of the mountains of Turkey, and he brought the Assyrians out of the hinterlands of Asia. God's hand is over all of history and all of mankind. His well-being and his love and his providence extend equally to all. The book of Ruth in our Bible is probably the most attractive and pointed lesson or parable in tolerance ever written. You know of the heroism of Ruth, how widowed herself, she left her homeland, her friends, the ways and customs and protection which she knew, to return to Bethlehem in Judah with her widowed mother, Naomi. Of this heroism we are all familiar. But what heightens the significance of this book is that Ruth is pictured as a Moabitess woman. And Moab was Israel's traditional enemy. When the Jews left Egypt, Moab inhabited what is today Transjordan. The Bible tells us that Moses asked of the Moabites free passage, peaceful passage through that land. And this passage was denied. Battle ensued. And for the first 4 or 5 centuries of Israelite existence, there was constant warfare, constant aggravation between the Moabite peoples and the Israelite peoples. So much was hatred built up on each side that in its only moment of prejudice, the Bible says that the Moabites must be exterminated and none of them must ever be allowed to enter the covenant of Israel, even unto the 10th generation. The book of Ruth stands as a protest against this human, perhaps understandable, but nevertheless despicable bitterness. The heroine is a Moabite. Imagine if an American author would write the great American saga and his heroine would be a Russian member of the Communist Party. This is the impact which the book of Ruth must have had upon the sensibilities of their day. And more than this, the author of the book of Ruth makes her into an ancestress of King David. David is not only the greatest of the kings of Israel, but all other kings come from his blood, from his root and stock. Moabite blood is therefore commingled with the blood of Israel's most noble aristocracy. Virtue can be found even among your enemies. What a tribute to the religious genius of our people that they saw fit to canonize this lesson in tolerance into our Bible. Our Bible, our faith, struggles to make us aware of the universality of virtue. We ourselves struggle each in his own way to become aware of it. Each of us has had experiences in which a light of truth dawned for us, in which we became aware that among certain groups whom we had hardly bothered to consider, you could find true, noble men and women. If we were honest with ourselves, we allowed these experiences to destroy our prejudices. If we are dishonest with ourselves, we accept the individual and say that he or she is not an example, a true example of the group. When I was in Chicago, I lived in a residential hotel. The maid was a woman of small stature, rheumatic. She seemed to be simply another of the hundreds of millions of people who inhabit the face of our globe. A name, a face, little more. I paid little attention to her. I somehow, in my arrogance, dismissed her as unworthy of my concern. One day we began to talk. She told me a little bit about herself. She had married a young man studying for the ministry. It was a decision between his dropping out of the seminary and her working. She was colored. A few other tasks, few other vocations besides housework were open to her. So she worked. He decided that missionary work was his métier. He could not earn a living wage at it. And so throughout the 30 years of their marriage, it has been a constant daily decision in which he gladly and freely works in order that he might fulfill the mission and the vocation which he has chosen for himself. And how many of us, if we are honest with ourselves, know of men and women of the outside groups who are sacrificing as parents every luxury of life that their children may be better educated than they were, that they may enjoy the fullness of America's bounty? How many of us know of neighbors from outside groups who have put down every personal concern when we or our families were in need? How many of us knew of impoverished families who are supporting a sick, invalided relative or friend? How many of us take to heart the lesson of the birthday of Abraham Lincoln, which we will all be commemorating and celebrating this week? I wonder if we had been parents in Springfield in the early 19th century, whether we would have encouraged our children to be friendly with the future president of the United States. He came of poor white trash. His father was a ne'er-do-well, rolling stone type of individual who could never long hold any job nor long remain in any place. His mother was an ordinary woman whose past was certainly not above reproach. If one were to add all the school credits earned by his ancestors for three generations, they would not equal one high school diploma. Culture, cultivation, these were certainly not to be found in his homes. Farmers, smithies, weavers, such were his ancestors. He himself had hardly any formal education. For long, he did not know how to dress or how to comport himself in good society. He lived by odd jobs and menial tasks, postal clerk, farmhand, handyman, and the like. What a rich opportunity our children would have missed had we counseled them, had we lived in that time, only to consort with children of the better families, had we worried that they were meeting and finding interesting a man of the people. And I wonder how many of us are not guilty of that same type of unconscious snobbishness today. A daughter tells us that she is in love with a man of the people. He is strong. He seems able, and yet we try to dissuade her because we feel that she ought to meet someone of her own set or of her betters. And we are not so concerned that she might not meet a person of the same virtues and same good character among that group. How often do we seek for ourselves entry into social clubs simply because they seem to be of society, of some higher order, without thought to the type of people who make up such social sets? How often do we tell our youngsters and encourage them to mingle with children of the better families indiscriminately without wondering and worrying whether these young people are strong, worthy heirs of their parents, or weaklings whom we would, if they came from other surroundings, hardly pause to consider? No, each of us must struggle in his own way to overcome the instinctive, almost preconceived set of social prejudices which we bear. And it is no easy task to overcome these prejudices, but it is an essential and all necessary one. It is essential because it is a teaching of our faith and a principle of the moral order. It is essential because it is a teaching of our democracy and the basis on which freedom of movement through class and caste must operate. It is essential because if we close ourselves from the strong and the able and the talented in all groups, we are denying ourselves the friendship, the inspiration, and the companionship of truly worthy people. And in our atomic age, in this our 20th century, it is a matter of sheer survival. No longer can any nation depend upon the brain power and the talents of a small in-group, white, old settlers, Protestant and the like, to fill all the offices, all the professions, and all the positions of leadership and skill. To survive in this atomic age, to meet its scientific, its political, its technological problems, will require the fullest use of every bit of our human resource. And if this human power, this creative power, this mental power happens to lodge in a brown skin or a white skin or a yellow skin, in a man who believes religiously other than you do or refuses simply to believe that which you do, if it happens to lodge in a newcomer or in an old settler, it must be used, it must be developed, it must be put to use. Every time an able man or woman is denied educational opportunity or a job opportunity, our national defense is weakened, our hope in the future is vitiated. The prejudices of past ages cannot be tolerated in the 20th century, because those nations which continue to enjoy these prejudices will find themselves quickly passed by nations which are ruthlessly extirpating them and destroying them by law. Now, fortunately, our country has taken great strides in the past decade or so towards finding the means of fully using these talents. And fortunately, the whole burden of our tradition points to a successful culmination. Our government especially has taken the lead. The armies, armed forces, have been ruthless in their unwillingness to tolerate prejudice. Today, rank, station, is open to men of all shades and tints. Public school systems have been opened in the last few years, and we are slowly adjusting ourselves to this new situation. But if we are to survive, we must realize that not only must the government assure each man equality of opportunity, that it may share of his mental prowess, but we must be willing to give the able of all peoples their full share of our national blessing in education, in the social life, in housing, in economic opportunity, and the like. And this will not be easy. It will mean that each and every one of us will have to overcome a great deal of learnt prejudice and instinctive fear. But I firmly believe that we have within us that religious faith, that human faith, sufficient unto the day and unto the problem, that we can confidently hope that through application, this problem can be solved if we will but bestir ourselves, and if we will but remember two lessons taught to us by the great emancipator whose birthday we are about to observe. He said once, "I am not particularly concerned about who my grandparents were, but I am greatly concerned what their grandson will be." Pride of ancestry, if it leads us to be noble out of duty, is a wonderful thing. But to rest on that pride, to judge others by their ancestors, is to be mistaken as to our standards. And he said also, "I find it difficult enough to find friends who interest me, who have something to teach me, from whom I may learn. Why should I deny myself arbitrarily the friendship of people whom I would respect?" If we can keep these two teachings to heart, we will have done much to live by the principles of our faith and much to make it possible for our country to live successfully in our new day. Amen.